This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. In the course of researching her latest book, Lynn Cheney found something she wasn't expecting. She discovered her husband, Republican Vice President Dick Cheney, is distantly related to Democratic presidential hopeful and Senator Barack Obama. They share a French Huguenot ancestor. Lynn Cheney discussed that bit of family history, among many other subjects, in a recent appearance at the National Press Club in Washington, and it's that speech we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. Lynn Cheney's career includes 7 years as chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities. She is also a prolific author, having published almost a book a year in her half-dozen years as Second Lady. Cheney has spoken out against the coarseness she hears in rap lyrics and sees in video games, and she has defended the Bush-Cheney approach to the war in Iraq. But Lynn Cheney has been somewhat less eager to talk about gay rights and her lesbian daughter. All those issues came up during the question and answer session we'll hear later this hour, but Lynn Cheney focused her formal remarks at her October 18th appearance at the National Press Club on her new memoir about growing up in Casper, Wyoming. Blue Skies, No Fences is the name of her book. Here then, author and Second Lady, Lynn Cheney.
I am so glad that members of my family could make it today. My daughter Liz is here. My granddaughter Elizabeth is here. My daughter Mary is on a shuttle from New York as we speak, and you know how unreliable that is, but we hope Mary will get here. And of course, I am so glad that Dick could make it today. You know, my husband is a great guy. He has been taking a lot of grief lately. Day after day, the Democrats running for president just wail on him, including Barack Obama. Now, I have told Barack he really does need to keep these disputes in the family. Over the last week or so, when I've been asked why I wrote this book, I've explained that it really began years ago when I began writing stories for my husband and my daughters for Christmas and birthdays. And in writing those stories, one of the resources I turned to was another relative who is here today, my Uncle Dale Vincent, Colonel Dale Vincent, and his wife, Mildred, who shared their stories with me. So I made Christmas and birthday presents because I really love the idea of homemade gifts. But as anyone who knows me will attest, I do not like spending time in kitchens, an aversion I believe I inherited. As I tell in my book, my mother didn't like to cook and was forever trying to get out of the kitchen as fast as possible. One of her methods was to cook everything on high. Which had certain disadvantages, particularly when combined with a 1950s device called a pressure cooker. If you left the heat under the pressure cooker on high for too long, which my mother did about once a month, the whole thing would explode, coating the stove and walls with broth and pasting bits of chicken to the ceiling so they hung down like tiny stalactites. So I am averse to cooking, way deep down in my genes, and deeply incompetent at it besides. But I can write. So instead of handing my loved ones boxes of divinity or tins of fruitcake, I've given them stories about the wonderful years in which Dick and I grew up and about the determined and hopeful people who made it possible for us to come of age in the Rocky Mountain West. I've explained this when I've been asked why I wrote this book. And it is a true answer. It's just not exactly a direct one. The answer that really addresses the question of why I wrote Blue Skies, No Fences, is that I loved the idea of it. More than any idea I've ever worked on, I knew it would be fun. And I'm not sure exactly why I've hesitated to admit that. Maybe I have a suspicion that when you are in public life, you aren't supposed to let it be known that you're having fun. But I was pretty sure from the outset that this book would be a project that would bring months, years indeed, of pleasure. And although writing is always hard work, it has done exactly that. The research for it has been a joy, whether it's been talking to my relatives, my friends, going through newspapers from my hometown from the 1940s and 50s, or reading some of the documents stored in great treasure houses like the National Archives. And I have learned so much. First and foremost, what memoir writing is about. When I started thinking about the memoirs I've loved, I realized that they weren't about the person who wrote them, so much as about other people, the men and women with whom the memoir writer shared a special time and place. When I think of Russell Baker's classic memoir, Growing Up, it's not Baker I remember so much as the Depression years in Baltimore and his amazing mother and his uncles and how familiar he made them all seem to me, though they were from a very different time and place than mine. So I hope that what my book conveys is the way we were in the years after World War II, the 1940s and 50s, decades of remarkable confidence and optimism, when the future seemed as bright as the blue skies overhead and the possibilities of life as endless as the prairies that surrounded our hometown of Casper, Wyoming. I hope readers will remember the people I write about, beginning with my mother, a remarkable woman whose family was living in a dugout when she was born, a cave essentially, hollowed out of the side of a hill with the opening framed in. This was not an unusual way for pioneer people, and Wyoming was the frontier, very much in the more recent past than other parts of the country, not an unusual way for pioneer people to house themselves while they were building another place to live. My mother grew up in a Wyoming oil field, lived for several years with her family in a rag town, a gathering of dwellings that took its name from the nature of those dwellings, tents essentially, with wood part way up the sides. She worked from the time I was small, first behind the soda fountain of Lloyd's Confectionery, which was less than a block from the house we lived in. She would take me with her, holding my hand as we crossed 13th Street, steering me past the mahogany stands and display cases inside the drugstore, then lifting me up onto one of the black leather and metal stools at the soda counter. "You stay here, Lenny," she would say, and I would, scribbling on paper napkins with a Crayola or playing with straws from the round dome holder that sat on the counter. "Say hi, Lenny," she'd tell me when someone she knew came in for a malt or a cherry phosphate. And on the rare occasions when there was a customer she didn't know, I would be introduced right after she had introduced herself. "This," she would say, "is my little girl, Lenny." My mother later joined the police force, and though her duties were mainly clerical, the job provided a perfect perch for monitoring my teenage activities. She had every patrol car in town reporting to her where I was at all times. She also became great friends with the fellows on the police force, as well as with the reporters who covered the county courthouse, and this meant she was usually in possession of some pretty interesting information. When a local man's wife was found buried in concrete in the basement of their home, she knew all the details before they were in the paper, including how the family's faithful Saint Bernard had led police to the grave by scratching on the cement. My mother's friendship with the reporters covering the police beat also meant she was in a perfect position to see that my every accomplishment was recognized in the way she thought it should be. By the time I was in high school, I had proved myself adept at an archetypal 1950s activity for girls, baton twirling. Now, I will tell you, for years after Dick and I came to Washington, I tried to keep this under wraps. Being sure that this part of my past would keep me from being regarded as a serious person. It was a great relief to me as the years advanced and I found out that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had also been a majorette. When I think about my 16-year-old self marching down small town streets all over Wyoming in front of the city band, I am struck by the absence of cynicism in our lives. It was a time when you could throw yourself into baton twirling or customizing cards or building floats for the homecoming parade without ever worrying about someone looking at you with a jaundiced eye. And for the most part, none of these activities eliminated you from other ones. You could be in car club and star in the school play or be the student body president. You could be editor of the annual, as one of my good friends named Paula was, and win the Pillsbury Bake Off for your peach cobbler. You could be a baton twirler and take third year Latin. You could even be a cheerleader one year, as a fellow we knew named Tolly Swallow was, and the next year play varsity football, as Tolly Swallow did. To an unusual degree, I think we grew up with the idea that we could be and do anything we wanted. And this was true far beyond Casper. Over the past 10 days, as I've talked to people who grew up all across the country, I've had so many say to me, "My life was like that too." And not just in terms of playing jacks and wearing poodle skirts and listening to the Everly Brothers, but in terms of growing up and thinking that the possibilities of life were unlimited. When I was a child, I used to dream that I could fly, that I could will myself off the ground and soar above the earth. And I suspect there were kids from California to Maine dreaming at night that if they just tried hard enough, they could fly. And during their waking hours, they were thinking that life was like that. If you were determined, the sky was the limit. The freedom we knew growing up was great for boys. One young man I knew played baseball and football and also hunted the prairies, fished the streams, and with his more daring friends, used the 500-foot spillway of one of the great dams near Casper as a water slide. But it was also a great time and place for girls. I was surrounded by strong women, mothers, aunts, grandmothers, teachers, and had imaginary role models I will never forget. Wonder Woman was my favorite. I think there had never been a character quite like her in history for little girls to identify with. I'd pump my tree swing as high as it would go, then bail out at the top, ready to deflect bullets with my magic bracelets. Many years later, Gloria Steinem would put Wonder Woman on the cover of the first issue of Ms. Magazine, and I would have a moment of complete empathy with the feminist movement.
Author Lynn Cheney, who is married to Vice President Dick Cheney, speaking October 18th at the National Press Club. Her new book is a memoir about growing up in Casper, Wyoming. It's called Blue Skies, No Fences. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Another character I admired was Sparkle Plenty, the beautiful daughter of Gravel Gertie and B.O. Plenty, who appeared in Dick Tracy comic strips. Although this was the 40s and 50s, and ambition was not often thought of as a desirable female trait, Sparkle wanted to conquer the world. She could play 27 tunes on her ukulele, some while standing on her head, a skill that led to an appearance on Ted Tellum's talent show, which she won so decisively that she was called back for a second performance. We didn't have Ted Tellum's talent show in Casper, but we did have the Bainbrick School of Dance. Located in a pink stucco building near the railroad tracks, it was run by Eddie and Clay Bainbrick, a colorful and hardworking couple. Eddie had red hair and spectacularly well-muscled legs. Eddie was the wife. Clay, the husband, wore his hair slicked back and his T-shirts tight. Not every mother thought the Bainbrick School of Dance was an entirely wholesome influence, but mine and many others did, and they took us to our weekly lessons, spent hours sewing up the costumes we needed for recitals. We were bunnies one time, hopping onto the stage at the Elks Club with white ears and cottontails, soft-shoeing to the tune of Glow, Little Glowworm, Glimmer, Glimmer. Our parents clapped and cheered, thrilled in these buoyant post-war years to have produced children who were such stars. The culture we grew up in was so child-friendly. You could sing the words to all the popular songs at the time to your grandmother. And all of television was one big family hour. And how great the programs were. Your Hit Parade, I Love Lucy, The Jackie Gleason Show. I have recently discovered that you can watch What's My Line, a great show of that time, on the Game Show Network. Or at least you can, if you're willing to TiVo it for later. I think it comes on at 1 in the morning. But for me, to watch it in Casper, Wyoming in the 1950s was to look into another culture. Here were erudite panelists trying to guess offbeat occupations wearing formal clothes. It was the first time I had ever seen a man in a black tie. John Charles Daly, Arlene Francis, Bennett Cerf, Dorothy Kilgallen chatted about Broadway shows and exotic vacations in places like Keneal Bay, the way we talked about going to the Skyline Drive-In or to a picnic on Casper Mountain. The adults in our lives had no hesitation about inculcating values. No notion that everything was relative and you ought to back off on questions of what kids should admire. We studied heroes in school, celebrated Washington's birthday and Lincoln's, and wrote poems about our first and 16th presidents. We learned to love the country, tell the truth, and work very hard. Looking at the Dick and Jane readers we used in grade school, I see now how busy everyone was. Sweeping, mowing, doing school assignments, making repairs and deliveries, even Spot the family dog kept an eye out for jobs he could do, like retrieving stuffed animals when baby Sally abandoned them. What we were supposed to value came through in our textbooks and in the examples adults set for us. My mother, my grandmother, and my aunts played a central role in one of the high dramas of my teenage years, which involved the man who is today vice president. We were 17 years old and had been going steady for a while when he decided one day that he wanted to play the field, as he put it. Upon hearing this news, my mother called my Aunt Norma, who arrived with a couple of spring dresses she had just made for herself and gave them to me to wear. My grandmother, immediately grasping that our strategy was to make me look as good as possible, and therefore make Dick really sorry for his wandering eye, took me downtown to a fancy department store, one I am sure she had never been in before, and bought me a glamorous black dress for an upcoming dance. Meanwhile, a friend of Dick's asked me out, a guy named Joe, who had the best car in town, a 1959 gold Pontiac Catalina convertible with a split grille and double fin blades in the rear. Wearing one of my aunt's new dresses, I cruised the A&W drive-in with Joe in that car, and soon enough, Dick saw the light. Playing the field, start to finish, lasted exactly 11 days. As much fun as the 50s were, they were neither perfect nor carefree. Television brought us the pictures of the Little Rock Nine trying to make their way into Little Rock High School through jeering crowds, and we knew that was wrong, and we knew President Eisenhower was exactly right to send in federal troops. We had no idea that getting students in the door was just the beginning, or that there were so many other civil rights battles yet to be fought. But as I look back over the 40 years since those images from Little Rock played out on our television set in Casper, I think the confidence we had that in America we could solve this problem, I think that confidence was warranted. We have traveled so far, and we are all the better for it. And although Sputnik worried us when it went up 40 years ago, we were also confident about our national strength in what we came to call the Cold War. 2 years after we graduated from high school, the Berlin Wall would go up. But 30 years after we graduated from high school, it would come down. Again, our faith in this great country was justified. Optimism, backed up to be sure, by determination and persistence, saw us through. Indeed, those were the attitudes and attributes that created the world we knew. We owed our childhood years of blue skies and no fences to forebears who had struggled mightily, persevering through all the calamities that are part of the American story, and remaining hopeful. My great-great-grandmother was converted to Mormonism in Wales in 1848. just a year after Brigham Young had settled in the valley of the Great Salt Lake. She was a servant girl who, I am sure, had never been more than a few miles from home. But she got on a ship, sailed across the Atlantic Ocean to New Orleans, took one steamship up the Mississippi, a second up the Missouri River, and then cholera struck, killing her young husband. A few months later, she had a baby, a son, and he died. But grandmother kept going, believing she would make it to the new Zion, which is how the Mormons thought of Utah, and she did. And she married again and had six children, one of whom was my great-grandfather. Dick's great-grandfather, after serving throughout the Civil War, an event in which 600,000 were killed, he made it through the Civil War and afterward, in a terrible accident in a sawmill, lost all the fingers on his left hand. He nevertheless kept going, homesteading in Nebraska, where he carved sod out of the plains and used it in that treeless land to build a four-room house for his family. After a few years, drought struck. He lost his farm. But in his 79th year, he homesteaded again, proving up his land before he died in 1911. Awe-inspiring as these stories are, they are not rare. The American past is filled with heroes and heroines who have no monuments, whose names aren't in the history books, but to whom we are most surely indebted. These men and women exist in the families of everyone in this room, I suspect. And one of the purposes of my book is to encourage people to seek out these stories. Family history, which used to involve a lot of tedium, has become a pleasure today because of the internet. So much information is now available online, and there is a kind of growing cooperative effort across the country down to the county level that is so helpful. In the notes on sources in the back of my book, I indicate some of the resources that are available. There are so many, and there are so many rewards. Looking at the past through the eyes of my forebears has helped me understand history in a way I did not before. And it is also a way to make the past compelling for children and young people. I have often lamented that they consider history the most boring subject in school. But they quickly become engaged when you involve them in the search for their forebears and in fleshing out the journeys taken by those who came before. I have discovered, and this is my last story, that even when you don't succeed in unearthing the fact that you want about a forebear, you often learn something else. A woman named America Lee, born in Illinois in 1841, married my great-great-grandfather. She was my great-great-grandmother. She married him sometime before 1860, and after having six children, died in 1874. Well, I wanted to know more about her. I mean, how could you not with this delightful name, America Lee? But despite all my best efforts, I could not find out more because I could not discover her maiden name. But while I was looking for it, I began to realize that her Christian name, America, seemed much more common at the end of the 1840s than at the beginning, which led me to think about that decade. When it began, Texas and everything west of the Continental Divide was foreign territory. When the 1840s ended, the American flag flew from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Many things drove this expansion, including the idea that a nation as great and good as ours ought to reign over the continent. Manifest destiny, I realized, motivated not only presidents and generals, it sprang from the hearts of farmers and shopkeepers and their wives, who in one of life's happiest moments looked at baby daughters and decided to pay tribute to the country. Going through the census data and doing a count, which is very easy to do in the age of computers and the internet, I found that in 1840, there were just 47 females named America in the United States. At the end of the decade, there were 5,081 of them, most west of the Appalachians, where the vision of expansion burned brightest. I have had so much happiness and learned so many things in the course of writing this book. And I hope all of you will enjoy it, too. Thank you.
Lynn Chaney is author of the new memoir, Blue Skies, No Fences, and the wife of Vice President Dick Cheney. You're hearing her on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After Lynn Cheney's October 18th speech at the National Press Club, she took questions from the audience. With those questions, here's Jerry Zaremski, president of the National Press Club.
Do you think people who grow up in the West look at the world differently? And if so, how?
It's hard to make large generalizations like that. But I think in our land where there aren't many people, our friend Al Simpson, how does he put it, Pete? We have more cows and antelopes than people, and we like it that way. you do tend to regard every other individual as important. You try not to ignore any of them. I take all of this, this is a huge generalization, from the way we walk down the street at home. And you walk down the street, and you have your head up, and you look other people in the eye. You can't do that in a large city. It would cause a lot of trouble. And, it's a way of avoiding other human beings. So maybe there's that. Certainly, in history, the openness of the West was a great difference that the pioneers noted. There are lots of tales about people actually going mad about the time they got to Scott's Bluff. You know, you'd run out of trees a long time ago. And suddenly there was this feeling of enormous vulnerability when there was above you no shelter but only that great sky, and around you no trees, no plant life, but only endless prairie. So I think it is psychologically different to grow up in a land like that. And the pioneers who saw it for the first time certainly felt that way.
Small-town America seems to be on the decline with more and more people moving to the major metro areas. How much does this concern you, and is there anything that can be done about it?
Well, I would regret were we to lose the resource of small towns in the 21st century. But I do know that jobs for young people are a considerable problem in many small towns. Even in our state, Wyoming, which is undergoing a great boom right now, a great energy boom, even in our state, young people are still leaving after high school or after college because there are so few job opportunities. Unless you want to go work in the gas fields, which many do, and many make a great deal of money, quite a fine salary doing that. But white-collar jobs are not as great as they should be. There aren't as many as they should be. And I know it's one of the problems my state is wrestling with, and I assume others are as well.
Many families today, through no fault of their own, lead very different lives than the ones that you recount in your book. Parents often live in the suburbs, may live a long way away from their jobs, may work extraordinarily long hours, and it all takes away time from families. How much difference do you think these facts make to the typical American family?
You know, there are so many good parents our society today, so many parents trying so hard. It's a less friendly culture to children now than it used to be. And what the good parents I observe do is build a little shelter against the culture. And it's too bad, really, that you have to build a shelter against influences you think aren't good for your children. But good parents say you do, and in fact, that's what they do. It does take time. It's very hard. In a town like Washington, where many families have two careers, to take the time to do that. But I've seen it happen in two career families. I think that's the important thing, is that dedication to being sure kids are protected. The culture they swim in now can be toxic. And, we need to try to make it as good for them as we can.
Our children today have as many opportunities as in the 50s, yet many are turning to drugs and other destructive behaviors that limit their success. How can the media encourage and provide a sense of optimism for future generations of leaders?
Whenever I see a positive story, a story about someone who has overcome, a story about someone who is succeeding against great odds, whenever I see this on television, I want to call my grandchildren in and be sure that they see this. There is the opportunity to tell good stories. It's so hard, I know, when you're in the media, because good stories don't seem as newsworthy usually as bad stories do. But those good stories, let me say, though, that for all the wonder of the 50s and all the joy we had growing up there, part of the good experience we had came about because drugs simply weren't available. My generation, and that's not exactly a generation, but the pre-baby boomers, you know, we're just ahead of the baby boomers. 5 years later, I was born in 1941. If you were born in 1946 or later, life changed. You know, it was one of those watershed years, 1946, when the baby boomers came along. Because when we grew up, when we were in high school and even in college, drugs weren't an option. It wasn't that we were especially virtuous. It's that they weren't part of the menu that you could choose from. 5 years later, you could choose from that menu, and it made an enormous difference. So positive stories about people who triumph over odds, maybe fewer stories about celebrities who are perhaps not triumphing over bad behavior would be most useful.
You mentioned drugs. Drugs have become not just an urban phenomenon in recent years and have increasingly touched rural areas of the country. Do you feel that the government's efforts to take care of the drug problem in rural areas has been as effective as it has been elsewhere?
I just think this is a challenge that we're going to face for decades yet to come, and that government efforts, while important, can only succeed if they're built upon the efforts of families, the efforts of parents to be watchful. But you're right, it is a problem even in our home state and in rural areas across the country. Not the drugs we used to think about, you know, maybe in the 60s and 70s, but methamphetamine is a disaster in many small communities.
You spoke of the wholesome lyrics of songs from your childhood. What do you think is at the root of the kind of controversial lyrics in some of the music of today?
I hesitate to speak out on this. I did it once, and I found myself a large figure on the screen at Eminem concerts. So I guess what I understand even less than why the lyrics are there is why it is regarded as so unfashionable or some kind of assault on free speech to speak out about them. I think we should all speak out about them. I think we should listen to them, first of all, and figure out what our kids are listening to. But it is, this is a question I would just pose to the audience for you to take home and think about. Why is it that we're not supposed to be angry about this? Why is it that we're not supposed to speak out about it? And why, for heaven's sakes, is it regarded as an issue of free speech? Don't parents and grandparents who are troubled by it have the right to speak freely?
You mentioned the internet and its role in researching family history, but in general, is the internet helping young people learn, or is it a time-consuming distraction for them?
So much depends on parents, doesn't it? So much depends upon who is in the home when kids get home from school. Doesn't have to be a parent. Has to be some sort of caregiver, though, who's paying attention. I think the internet is transformative. When I was a little girl, I read a book by Arthur C. Clarke called Childhood's End. And I would recommend this book to all of you. It's very old now. It's science fiction, but it's so good. It was the inspiration, I think, for the movie Independence Day. Remember when the big flying saucers came down and were close to the Earth? Well, that's sort of where it starts. But by the end of the novel, something has happened, and it happens to the young people. And I'd call it almost a hiving behavior. Suddenly, they're all connected. And suddenly, they've left behind the generation before them that isn't connected in that way. So prescient, it seems to me, this novel is. I think the internet is transformative. It's here. It's an amazing tool for research and knowledge and learning. But it is something that parents need to be careful about and that caregivers need to tend to.
Okay, moving beyond the topics covered in your book, one questioner asks, you're a highly accomplished woman. Why only a moment of empathy with the feminist movement? What's wrong with feminists?
I love feminists, but they don't often love people who are Republican. And so that has proved a bit of a stumbling block for me.
Lynn Cheney, wife of Vice President Dick Cheney, taking questions in an October 18th appearance at the National Press Club. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
As a smart, educated woman, do you have any advice to give to other women about how to deal with men who think you should only be allowed to twirl a baton?
You know, it's hard to imagine that such people exist in our liberated times. And, you know, the values that I took away from growing up in Wyoming are good for people generally, but perhaps especially good for women. Maybe we still do have to work harder than men to achieve the same goals, but having in yourself in the first place that idea that working hard is not only the source of achievement but of great pleasure is maybe the most valuable thing that we can give to our daughters and our granddaughters, and that we can treasure ourselves.
You mentioned that sense of national optimism and confidence of the 1950s. Has that changed in recent years, and if so, why?
You know, I think it has. But if you remember what I said about the 1950s, our optimism and confidence was partly based on not seeing the problems, and particularly in not being aware until the 50s drew to a close, of the threat of communism, the Soviet Union. We were having a little holiday from history. In a sense, we had that same holiday from history during the 1990s, when we thought, ooh, the Cold War is over, we're safe, it's the end of history, someone wrote. And it turns out, of course, that it wasn't. So yes, I think we are less confident, but I think our realism is very, very healthy. And the optimism about the strength of this country and our ability to overcome whatever challenges we face is, I think, one that we should value very much. So maybe we aren't as confident, but I think we can be optimistic about America.
We have quite a few somewhat political questions.
Uh-oh.
Including this. Your husband has been the target of extraordinary criticism in recent years. Has it changed him?
You know, I think Dick and I are very lucky to have spent 40 years in politics before being in politics in the current day. This is a really nasty environment. Take it from me. But if you've been around for a while, you know, this shouldn't be the case, and maybe it's too bad it has to be the case, but you do develop something of a thick skin. And so it just kind of rolls off. So that's one thing. I would hate to be a young person entering politics today without having gone through that period of, what's that word, acclimation? Acclimatization? You know what I'm trying to say, the period of getting used to it that we've had. I will also tell you, though, that sometimes the attacks are so bizarre and so surreal, as in this whole Darth Vader thing, that, you know, it's a source of humor. And I think that's a very good way to deal with political adversity, is to laugh at it. I had a great deal of fun going on the Jon Stewart show and giving him a little Darth Vader doll.
How much responsibility do Republicans bear for the political polarization in the country today?
Hardly any. As I said to Jon Stewart, what kind of question is that?
Is it a shared responsibility between the two parties?
I've answered it.
Okay. Okay, moving along to really a more serious question. As the mother of a gay daughter, how do you feel about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act?
You know, first of all, I don't like questions that reflect on the fact that fail to reflect the fact that I have two daughters. And I'm very happy that my daughter Liz is here today, and I would like all of you, my daughter Mary did get on the shuttle in time, and she's here. So that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
How do you feel about the Republican presidential candidates?
I have a lot of friends who are moaning and groaning and, rubbing their foreheads, and I tell them, snap out of it. We have some good candidates. Dick and I are scrupulously neutral in who ought to emerge from the primary contest, but we have some good candidates. And I'm especially impressed when I listen to both the Democratic debates and the Republican debates about how sound the Republican candidates are on issues of national security. That gives me a great deal of comfort, frankly. When I vote in 2008, that will be my main issue. Not my only one, to be sure. All of these other issues that people are concerned about are important, but that will be the main one for me, and I'm very glad to see people on our side of the aisle who are projecting such strength when it comes to how do we deal with the challenges that face us in the 21st century.
As someone with a Mormon family background, how do you feel about the focus on Mitt Romney's Mormonism?
Frankly, I've been appalled by some of it. I've read articles on the Internet, and I know I shouldn't be on the Internet reading articles. But, not in obscure sources. There was one in Slate magazine that spoke about Mormonism in such virulent terms that it was just shocking to me. I mean, I thought we had long ago passed the time when we looked at someone's religion and held it up and tried to tear it apart to see if this person were qualified to be president. Most religions don't stand up well to that kind of test, where you subject them to rational tearing apart and analysis. That's not what religion is about. It's not a left-brained activity. It's a right-brained activity. It's about belief, and we should let people have their beliefs and quit criticizing them for it.
You've had some critical things to say about Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. How well do you know her, or is your criticism based on what she says and does publicly?
I think I've probably been even-handed in criticizing all the Democratic candidates for president.
Even family.
I'm getting quite fond of Barack, actually. I'm trying to think what I've said. I think what I've said basically is that because I am a national security voter, I have been troubled by her national security statements, which seem inconsistent and deliberately so. Voting against funding for the war, but voting or saying in a debate that we would have troops in Iraq perhaps through 2013. It's one of these things where for every yin, there's a yang, so pretty soon you don't know what is going to be the next statement. The only thing I can be sure of about Mrs. Clinton's stance on Iraq is that there'll be another one.
There is a poll out that says that 25% of Republican women would vote for Hillary Clinton. Any comment on that?
I think it's really too bad if we, make gender even the basis for a polling question. Just as we should have passed beyond a person's religion as relevant to whether he or she is qualified for high office, I think gender ought to be irrelevant. It ought to be the person who can lead us best in a time of challenge.
You mentioned what you see as Senator Clinton's inconsistency on foreign policy. Senator Obama has been widely criticized for some of his comments on foreign policy, a willingness perhaps to meet with dictators that other candidates would not meet with. What are your thoughts on what he's had to say on foreign policy on the campaign trail?
I honestly think that Senator Obama has been criticized for those stands in a way that perhaps some of the other Democratic candidates haven't been for their stands. It really caused a kind of firestorm when he has said some of the things he said, when he quit wearing his flag pin, for example. So, I think there's been a pretty close eye on Senator Obama.
How do you feel about multicultural education?
Well, I'm all for it. But first of all, we need to teach children about the country in which they live. We need to be sure they have a strong and sturdy foundation in American history. And then, of course, we should move on to let them know about the whole world in which they will live, and in which they will live in a much more interconnected way than any of us have. So multicultural education is a good thing. It's just that it needs to be balanced and coupled with a very deep and strong education in the history of the United States.
Now some kind of forward-looking questions. You and Vice President Cheney have been part of the fabric of Washington for decades. Where will the Cheneys spend their time after the next president is elected? Washington, Wyoming, somewhere else?
You know, I'm sure we'll probably be around. I'll be able to wave to you all from time to time. But we're certainly going to spend more time in Wyoming. I have regretted over these past 7 years it's been now, every September and October, we're not there. Now, August is a wonderful time, and we often get to Wyoming in August. But as Dick will tell you, and my daughters will tell you, my granddaughters, as Pete Williams will tell you, in September and October, the aspen turn and the cottonwood turn, and in the beautiful valley in which we live, there are these great swaths of gold against the blue mountains, the Tetons. It is a time of most incredible beauty, and I can guarantee that we will be there in September and October.
Well, perhaps that's related to the next question, which is, after you and Vice President Cheney leave the White House, would you consider a political career of your own?
I've had a lot of byways in my life. As the people at the table from the National Endowment for the Humanities will testify, I even thought I could be an academic once. So I've gone down a number of different byways, but I think what I've discovered is that writing is my career, that writing is what I love to do. Bringing order out of the chaos of thought, bringing order out of the chaos of research gives me such great pleasure. And another thing that has given me pleasure is that my granddaughter Elizabeth, sitting over there, is she still with us? Tells me she wants to be a writer.
One of our questioners writes, "You have written some racy novels. Are you going to write more?"
Yes.
You're listening to Word for Word from American Public Media and Second Lady Lynn Cheney, author most recently of Blue Skies, No Fences. The next question in this National Press Club session makes reference to another author in the political spotlight, Virginia Democratic Senator Jim Webb.
Just out of curiosity, we had Senator Webb here a few months ago. Uh-huh. Have you ever read any of his books, and what do you think of them?
He's actually written a book on the Scots-Irish. His family. His mother's side of the family is Scots-Irish. These are people who came from Northern Ireland. They came from Ulster. They were Protestants. Driven out of Ireland for many reasons, they came by the tens of thousands, including Dick's ancestors and including some of Jim Webb's ancestors. So he wrote a wonderful book about it, and I look forward to doing more research and seeing if perhaps Dick and Jim Webb are related.
Please elaborate about the family relationship with your husband and Barack Obama. Also, have you planned to reach out to him for a conversation and possibly invite him to a family reunion?
We have always known in our family about Dick's Puritan ancestors, the Cheneys that came to Massachusetts. They were escaping Charles I. He was persecuting Puritans, and so they left England and came to Massachusetts, and it's a very interesting branch of the family. But in the course of doing this book, I discovered another Cheney branch, and it goes over to Maryland. It's so interesting. You know, one branch of Cheneys came to escape Charles I. The second branch probably came to escape his successor, Cromwell, who beheaded Charles I. They were anti-royalists, or they were royalists. The Puritans were the anti-royalists. So I found this other branch. It's amazing. There is a house right now being excavated near Annapolis that was the place where the first Richard Cheney came in 1658 to Maryland. So this is just, it's very rich historically. And I got that genealogy pretty well in hand when I read in the newspaper one day, I think it was the Baltimore Sun, that someone had done a genealogy for Senator Obama. And they mentioned that one of his ancestors had been Maureen Duval. That's the name of a man. And Maureen Duval was also in Dick's family tree. They both, one way to describe the relationship is to say they're both descendants of this Frenchman who came to Maryland, no doubt seeking religious freedom, because Maryland was known for tolerance. So I think this is actually quite a wonderful American story, that a Frenchman who came to the United States seeking religious freedom would have descendants, lo, all these many years later, who have led such diverse lives as my husband and the senator have.
With all the family research you did for this book, did you uncover any genealogical connections to other presidential candidates such as Mike Gravel, Dennis Kucinich, and Hillary Clinton?
No. And, you know, in fact, what I was really interested in is not people you've heard of. The stories I was most anxious to uncover were those hidden heroes that I talked about while I was speaking, the men and women who aren't in museums, whose names you don't know, but whose strength and determination and optimism built America. So those were the stories I concentrated on.
Great. Thank you.
Lynn Cheney, writer and wife of Vice President Dick Cheney. Her latest book, Blue Skies, No Fences, looks back at growing up in Wyoming in the 1940s and 50s. She spoke October 18th at the National Press Club. If you missed part of this hour's speech by Lynn Cheney, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. In addition to hearing this week's show, you may subscribe to our free weekly podcast and go to our archives to listen to any of our previous programs, including speeches by author and Democratic Senator Jim Webb of Virginia, Iraq scholar Ellen Lapson, and The World Without Us author Alan Wiseman. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penkava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.